Iran says it would remain committed to the 2015 nuclear deal as long as other signatories to the accord live up to their commitments. At least 20 people are killed and more than 20 others injured in an earthquake that hit Pakistan's southwestern Baluchistan province. And NATO expels 8 members of Russia's mission to the alliance, calling them undeclared intelligence officers. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says Tehran would remain committed to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal as long as other signatories to the accord keep their side of the bargain. Majid Takht-Ravanchi also called for the removal of sanctions against Iran in a quick and verifiable way. He criticized the noncompliance of some of the parties of the deal, saying the undeniable truth is that the United States and the Europeans have not fulfilled their commitments. Iran and the remaining signatories to the agreement have tried to salvage the deal since the U.S. withdrew from it and reimposed sanctions on Iran in 2018. Well, Iran's foreign minister says the Islamic Republic will not spare efforts to help Lebanon if asked. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments upon his arrival in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. He said Iran is confident that Lebanon will manage to overcome its hardships. The top diplomat further congratulated the Lebanese people for forming a new government. Amir Abdullahian is set to meet Lebanese President Michel Aoun, Parliament Speaker Nambiberi, Prime Minister Najib Mikati, and Foreign Minister Abdullah Bouhabib. He's also scheduled to sit down for talks with Palestinian factions. And now to Pakistan, where at least 20 people have been killed in an earthquake that rocked the southwestern Baluchistan province. Most of the victims died after roofs and walls collapsed as they were sleeping. More than 200 others have also been injured. Pakistan's disaster management officials say the toll may increase. According to the U.S. Geographical Survey, the Tembler was 5.7 magnitude on the Richter scale. It struck at about 3 a.m. local time at a depth of about 20 kilometers. The quake was felt in the provincial capital, Quetta, and in other cities in Baluchistan. Well, NATO has expelled 8 Russian representatives to the Western Military Alliance, accusing them of being, quote, undeclared intelligence officers. A NATO official has been quoted as saying that the alliance also announced that it would reduce members of Russia's mission to the Brussels-based body to 10. He stressed that the move is aimed at strengthening the alliance's deterrence in response to, quote, Russia's aggressive actions. A senior Russian diplomat has said his country will retaliate against NATO's move. Now, the Russian diplomats have reportedly been asked to leave by the end of the month. A British news network said NATO members decided on the expulsion after reviewing suspected Russian malign activities over the summer. Moscow has always denied any wrongdoing. France says its dispute over a recent security pact between the U.S. and Australia that led Canberra to ditch a submarine deal with Paris remains serious and unresolved. Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian said the resumption of dialogue between the two countries doesn't mean the crisis is resolved. Le Drian stressed that the U.S. needs to show actions, not words, to get out of this situation. He made the remarks despite acknowledging substantive talks with his U.S. counterpart in Paris. The presidents of the two countries are also set to meet next week. The transatlantic route was triggered after the U.S. and the U.K. inked a deal with Australia, known as AUKUS, to provide it with technology and means to build nuclear-powered submarines. Later, Canberra announced the cancellation of a multi-billion-dollar submarine deal with Paris. Meanwhile, a debate in the European Parliament underlines the extent to which trust between the EU and the U.S. has diminished. Many lawmakers say it's time the 27-country bloc learned to stand on its own 2 feet. Jerome Hughes brings us more from Brussels.
We had become well used to hearing Donald Trump being slated in the European Parliament during debates, but perhaps didn't expect that his successor, Joe Biden, would also attract scathing criticism.
He did not consult us when he withdrew from Afghanistan. He completely sidelined us in the AUKUS deal.
AUKUS relates to a new military pact between Canberra, London and Washington. It means a deal involving France building submarines for Australia has been scrapped. This has created big tensions between the EU and the US. The reaction from European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen to the tensions has not gone down well.
We have a Commission President who recently proclaimed her empire, stating European military forces would be part of the solution. When will the EU recognize it is part of the problem, not the solution?
Some legislators say the EU can no longer talk about values while at the same time cowering to America.
This is a country which is ruthlessly pursuing an espionage case against Julian Assange for publishing information about US war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq, including attempts to kidnap and kill him.
Many members of the European Parliament claim the Donald Trump era proves that EU leaders will never stand up to the United States.
For example, what did they do when Trump tried to start trade wars, took the US out of the Paris Climate Agreement, withdrew funding for Palestinian refugees and supported Israel's illegal occupation program? And what about his rubbishing of the World Health Organization amid a global pandemic?
Lawmakers say revelations that the US continues to spy on top EU politicians, officials and institutions has also eroded trust. Experts agree.
It is absolutely central to explore ways in which trust could be re-established across the Atlantic. Trust not only between governments, but also private sector and individuals who are very much concerned about, you know, how their data and their information is used.
Members of the European Parliament, MEPs, say Biden's failure to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal, despite indicating he would, also illustrates how the United States cannot be trusted. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An estimated 200,000 people have demonstrated against economic austerity in France after unions called the first nationwide strike since the outbreak of the coronavirus. Major cuts to unemployment insurance are set to go into effect despite widespread economic uncertainty and continually increasing inequality. Ramin Mazahiri brings us more from Paris.
From the yellow vests to the longest general strike the country has ever seen, France under President Emmanuel Macron has been the site of constant grassroots expression, but also shocking political repression. For the first time since the coronavirus epidemic began, France's unions called a nationwide strike, with protests taking place in over 200 cities and towns.
Unions and workers are accusing politicians and bosses of manipulating the corona crisis in order to ram through more far-right economic austerity measures. Deeply unpopular cuts to unemployment insurance take effect this week, despite the ongoing economic uncertainty.
The government has used a pretext of health concerns, cut wages, to cut government jobs, to reduce worker rights, and to allow bad working conditions to get even worse. It's great to see everyone from workers to students to pensioners back in the streets again, because these cuts to unemployment are unacceptable during these tough times.
A decade of failed austerity, followed by the unprecedented corona recession, has given France's lower and middle classes a list of problems too long to fully mention. Inflation, energy prices, intense corona-related restrictions on personal freedom, unemployment, soaring inequality. But perhaps most telling is that even conservative politicians now talk of the need to, quote, make work pay, because French wages and salaries have been so stagnant for so long.
La vie a augmenté à tous les niveaux.
The cost of living does nothing but increase, and in seemingly every possible way. Costs are even higher than when the yellow vests first began. But we haven't been allowed to demonstrate. Until salaries are increased, things will continue to be more and more difficult for the French.
Protesters say that the coronavirus lockdowns and work cutbacks are too often presented as some sort of welcome and generously subsidized vacation. The reality is they have been catastrophic for many average households. The French street is alive with protest for the first time in over 1.5 years,
and it may decide the outcome of Macron's re-election bid this April. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Well, Austrian prosecutors have placed Chancellor Sebastian Kurz under investigation over alleged bribery and breach of trust. Anti-corruption prosecutors announced a probe after raids on the offices of Kurz's Conservative Party and several top aides. He's accused of using state funds to manipulate opinion polls in favor of his party between 2016 and 2018. In a statement, prosecutors said the chancellor and nine others were also questioned over various offenses. Meanwhile, Kurz's People's Party dismissed the raid on its headquarters as politically motivated. Earlier this year, Kurz was put under investigation for possible false statements to a parliamentary committee on corruption, but was not charged. Now, moving on to other news this hour, rights activists say Saudi Arabia has lobbied heavily against a UN probe into possible war crimes committed by Riyadh and its allies in Yemen. Activists say Riyadh is against a Western resolution that would extend the mandate of UN investigators who have documented crimes in Yemen. The Geneva-based UN Human Rights Council is set to debate the motion on Thursday. An expert group set up by the council in 2017 has repeatedly said that Saudi-led airstrikes and shelling may amount to war crimes. Meanwhile, a rights advocate said the UN rights body's inaction under Saudi pressure would be, quote, a stain on its credibility. Tens of thousands of Yemenis have been killed and millions of others displaced since Saudi Arabia launched its devastating war and imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen in 2015. Well, journalist and political commentator Eric Wahlberg believes the United Nations has to take action to hold Saudi Arabia accountable for its war crimes in Yemen.
Well, it looks like it's at its end game, and it's scrambling to save some kind of face. So that's why it's still resisting. But it's so true that the crimes are largely on the Saudi side from the war that it's been waging for over 5 years now. So by ignoring that and ignoring also the crimes of the Hadi government against its own allies in the south that were fighting ISIS, there have been many arrests in the last week. So it looks like it's trying to, with the Saudis trying to really tighten its hold at the end, in its end game. It's a very cynical ploy, and it's wrong for the UN not to stand up. It should. There's lots of evidence now, and it's not as if it's taking any great bold move by just taking the Saudis to task for its war crimes.
A Saudi appeals court has reportedly upheld a lengthy prison sentence handed to aid worker Abdurrahman al-Sadhan earlier this year by a counterterrorism court. Sadhan's sister, Arij, in a tweet, said that the appeal court approved the initial ruling of 20 years in prison, followed by a 20-year travel ban. She said her brother was detained in March of 2018 without a warrant or charges against him. Rights groups say he was seized after his anonymous Twitter account was breached. Saudi authorities have detained senior royals, activists, intellectuals, and clerics as de facto ruler Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has moved to crush dissent. Well, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a rally to commemorate the 34th anniversary of the founding of the Islamic Jihad movement. The group was founded by the late Dr. Fatih Shaqaqi, who was inspired by the Islamic Revolution in Iran and the teachings of its late founder, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. More in the following report.
October 6 marks the anniversary of the outset of the Islamic Jihad movement. Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip from all walks of life have come out to show their support for the movement. The Islamic Jihad was founded by the late Dr. Fatih Shaqaqi, who was inspired by Iran's Islamic Revolution and the teachings of its late founder, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. Shaqaqi viewed the Islamic Revolution as a role model for the Arab world and believed in the principle of Wilayat-e-Faqih, which means the rule of the Islamic jurisprudence.
As we mark the blessed anniversary of the Islamic Jihad movement in Gaza, the solid rock of resistance against the Zionist regime, we wish to express our deepest gratitude, love, and appreciation to the Islamic Republic of Iran for all of its support. Iran has always been helping us in our fight against the occupation, and it did not spare any effort to help us.
During the rally, Islamic Jihad senior officials urged Palestinians to increase their resistance against the Israeli occupation forces all across Palestine. The group's Secretary General, Dr. Ziad Nakhala, called on all Palestinian factions to uproot the Israeli regime from the land of Palestine.
On this occasion, we renew our pledge and allegiance to the Islamic Jihad movement, which continues to fight against the Zionist regime for the sake of liberating Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Palestine will always remain a focal issue for our nation.
The movement is highly respected by all Palestinian factions and has always been a unifying factor among them. The movement and its leaders, however, remain blacklisted by the European Union and the United States for refusing to recognize the Israeli regime.
34 years on, the popularity of the Islamic Jihad movement continues to grow among Palestinians due to the movement's strict adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli occupation. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
China has told the United States that any confrontation between Beijing and Washington will cause serious damage to both countries. China's top diplomat, Yang Jiechi, issued the warning during a meeting with U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan in the Swiss city of Zurich. The Chinese official called the meeting comprehensive and frank. He said the two sides have agreed to take action to properly manage differences and to avoid conflict. In the meantime, the White House said U.S. President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping are set to hold a virtual meeting by the end of the year. Now, the Chinese president had earlier rejected Biden's calls for a meeting, citing rising tensions in their bilateral ties. Now, the World Food Program has warned that a humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan is growing alarmingly worse as the country's economy is on the brink of collapse.
The 38 million Afghans who still live in the country are adjusting to a new reality. It is incredibly sad. And over the weeks, a humanitarian crisis has just escalated and magnified at an incredible pace. It's a crisis that has its roots in decades of conflict.
The UN official added that 18 million people in Afghanistan already had, quote, a humanitarian crisis of incredible proportions before the Taliban seized power. McCarthy noted that the number is expected to increase, in particular regarding issues like food and malnutrition. She urged the international community to be more generous in providing aid to Afghanistan as it prepares for the winter season. Afghanistan's overseas reserves have been frozen since the Taliban came to power in August. And with that, brings us to the end of this Worldness edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. However horrifying the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol appeared in the moment, we now know that it was far worse. The country was hours away from a full-blown constitutional crisis, not primarily because of the violence and mayhem inflicted by hundreds of President Donald Trump's supporters, but because of the actions of Donald Trump himself. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece is titled, January 6th Was Worse Than We Knew. The editorial board is a group of opinion journalists whose views are informed by expertise, research, and debate. However horrifying the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol appeared in the moment, we now know that it was far worse. The country was hours away from a full-blown constitutional crisis, not primarily because of the violence and mayhem inflicted by hundreds of President Donald Trump's supporters, but because of the actions of Donald Trump himself. In the days before the mob descended on the Capitol, a corollary attack, this one bloodless and legalistic, was playing out down the street in the White House, where Mr. Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, and a lawyer named John Eastman huddled in the Oval Office, scheming to subvert the will of the American people by using legal sleight of hand. John Eastman's unusual visit was reported at the time, but a new book by the Washington Post journalists Bob Woodward and Robert Costa provides the details of his proposed six-point plan. It involved Vice President Mike Pence rejecting dozens of already certified electoral votes representing tens of millions of legally cast ballots, thus allowing Congress to install Donald Trump in a second term. Mike Pence ultimately refused to sign on, earning him the rage of Donald Trump and chants of "Hang Mike Pence" by the rioters, who erected a makeshift gallows on the National Mall. The fact that the scheme to overturn the election was highly unlikely to succeed is cold comfort. Donald Trump remains the most popular Republican in the country. Barring a serious health issue, the odds are good that he will be the party's nominee for president in 2024. He also remains as incapable of accepting defeat as he has ever been, which means the country faces a renewed risk of electoral subversion by Donald Trump and his supporters. Only next time, they will have learned from their mistakes. That leaves all Americans who care about preserving this republic with a clear task. Reform the federal election law at the heart of Mr. Eastman's twisted ploy and make it as hard as possible for anyone to pull a stunt like that again. The Electoral Count Act, which passed more than 130 years ago, was Congress's response to another dramatic presidential dispute, the election of 1876, in which the Republican Rutherford Hayes won the White House despite losing the popular vote to his Democratic opponent, Samuel Tilden. After Election Day, Samuel Tilden led in the popular vote and in the Electoral College, but the vote in three southern states, South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana, was marred by accusations of fraud and intimidation by both political parties. Various officials in each state certified competing slates of electors, one for Rutherford Hayes and the other one for Samuel Tilden. The Constitution said nothing about what to do in such a situation, so Congress established a 15-member commission to decide which electors to accept as valid. The commission consisted of 10 members of Congress, evenly divided between the two political parties, and five Supreme Court justices, two appointed by Democrats and three appointed by Republicans. Rutherford Hayes, the Republican candidate, won all the disputed electors, including one from Oregon, by an 8-7 vote, giving him victory in the Electoral College by just a single vote. Democrats were furious and began to filibuster the counting process but they eventually accepted Rutherford Hayes's presidency in exchange for the withdrawal of the last remaining federal troops from the South, ending Reconstruction and beginning the era of Jim Crow, which would last until the middle of the 20th century. It was obvious that Congress needed clearer guidelines for deciding disputed electoral votes. In 1887, the Electoral Count Act became law, setting out procedures for the counting and certifying of electoral votes in the states and in Congress. But the law contains numerous ambiguities and poorly drafted provisions. For instance, it permits a state legislature to appoint electors on its own, regardless of how the state's own citizens voted, if the state failed to make a choice on election day. But what does that mean? The law doesn't say. It also allows any objection to a state's electoral votes to be filed as long as just one senator and one member of the House put their names to it, triggering hours of debate, which is how senators like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley were able to gum up the works on 6th of January. A small minority of legal scholars have argued that key parts of the Electoral Count Act are unconstitutional, which was the basis of John Eastman's claim that Mike Pence could simply disregard the law and summarily reject electors of certain key battleground states. Nothing in the Constitution or federal law gives the vice president this authority. The job of the vice president is to open the envelopes and read out the results, and nothing more. Any reform of the Electoral Count Act should start there, by making it explicit that the vice president's role on 6th of January is purely ministerial and doesn't include the power to rule on disputes over electors. The law should also be amended to allow states more time to arrive at a final count, so that any legal disputes can be resolved before the electors cast their ballots. The failed election provision should be restricted to natural disasters or terrorist attacks, and even then, it should be available only if there is no realistic way of conducting the election. Remember that in 2012, election was held just days after Hurricane Sandy lashed the East Coast, and yet all states were able to conduct their elections in full. This is another good argument for universal mail-in voting, which doesn't put voters at the mercy of the weather. The key point is that a close election, even a disputed election, is not a failed election. Finally, any objection to a state's electoral votes should have to clear a high bar. Rather than just one member of each chamber of Congress, it should require the assent of one quarter or more of each body. The grounds for an objection should be strictly limited to cases involving clear evidence of fraud or widespread voting irregularities. The threats to a free and fair presidential election don't come from Congress alone. Since 6th of January, Republican-led state legislatures have been clambering over one another to pass new laws making it easier to reject their own voters' will, and removing or neutralizing those officials who could stand in the way of a naked power grab, like Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, like he did when he resisted Donald Trump's personal plea to find just enough extra votes to flip the outcome in Georgia. How to ensure that frivolous objections are rejected while legitimate ones get a hearing? One approach would be to establish a panel of federal judges in each state to hear any challenges to the validity or accuracy of the state's election results. If the judges determine that the results are invalid, they would lay out their findings in writing and prevent the state from certifying the results. There is plenty more to be done to protect American elections from being stolen through subversion, like mandating the use of paper ballots that can be checked against reported results. Ideally, fixes like these would be adopted promptly by bipartisan majorities in Congress to convey to all Americans that both political parties are committed to a fair, transparent, and smooth vote-counting process. But for that to happen, the Republican Party would need to do a U-turn. Right now, some Republican leaders in Congress and the states have shown less interest in preventing election sabotage than in protecting and, in some cases, even venerating the saboteurs. Democrats should push through these reforms now and eliminate the filibuster if that's the only way to do so. If they hesitate, they should recall that a majority of the Republican caucus in the House, 139 members to be exact, along with 8 senators, continue to object to the certification of electoral votes even after the mob stormed the Capitol building. Time and distance from those events could have led to reflection and contrition on the part of those involved, but that's not so. Remember how, in the frantic days before 6th of January, Donald Trump insisted over and over again that Georgia's election was rife with large-scale voter fraud. Remember how he called on Mr. Raffensperger to start the process of decertifying the election and announce the true winner. Only those words aren't from last year. They actually appear in a letter that Donald Trump sent to Mr. Raffensperger just 2 weeks ago. Donald Trump may never stop trying to undermine American democracy. Those who value that democracy should never stop using every measure at their disposal to protect it.
Food for thought. Salam, dear listeners, and let us listen to a thought-provoking saying from the Prophet's 8 infallible heir, Imam Reza, peace upon him. The worst earner of livelihood is that who deprives others of improving their livelihoods through his earnings.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Sinful Feast. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Even if one does not commit the sin and does not cooperate with participants of the feast, participation in a sinful feast is itself a sin. It amounts to endorsing a sin unless one participates in order to remedy the situation and perform the critical duty of enjoining good and forbidding evil. You know, for someone to be able to participate and be part of a sinful feast, there's only one exception Islam has provided, and that is that you go there to rectify the situation, to do the amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar, which is bidding the good and forbidding the evil. That's the only exception where a believer may be, in some cases, allowed to be part of the sinful feast. Furthermore, when a person keeps observing sinful scenes with indifference and without protest, without, you know, an attempt to rectify the situation, it darkens his spirit and decreases his sensitivity so that sins no longer appear so bad to him. And this can lead him to commit sins. You know how we get intoxicated with these sins, and then this intoxication becomes the normal, the new normal. We start living with these sins without even feeling. We don't even, you know, realize that we're living a sinful life because now we have become accustomed and used to of these sins. Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, who's the sixth infallible imam, has said, "It is unjust for believers to participate in a feast where sin is performed, and they do nothing to change the situation." Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the sinful feast and what the responsibility of a believer, of a mu'min, is. We said that for a believer, for somebody who believes in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for somebody who believes in the Prophet of Allah, for somebody who believes in the Book of Allah, for somebody who believes in the infallibility and the infallible imams sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they are under no circumstances allowed to be part of a sinful gathering, sinful feast, where music is being played, where sometimes, God forbid, alcohol is being served. They're not allowed to be part of it.
The only exception we said that Islam has provided is that if this person is going there to rectify the situation. So in other words, this person is not allowed to take any effect from the sin. And if he knows that he's going to get affected by the sinful, you know, party or gathering, then it is not allowed for him to be part of that gathering, to go there to attend that. This is a common issue we see today, especially in the Western world. The Muslim youth, the Shia youth, since they're growing up with non-Muslims, where sinful gatherings are common, they feel that they have no choice but to attend those gatherings because of peer pressure sometimes, because they want to live a normal life, you know, they just want to gel with others. So they feel that they have to be part of that sinful gathering. But Islam has told us under no circumstances you are allowed to be, if you're a believer, you're allowed to be part of these sinful gatherings. You have to resist, you have to protest, you have to rise up and, you know, fight against these sinful gatherings. Otherwise, it's going to taint your own spirituality. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Plastic pollution has become one of the most pressing environmental issues as disposable products overwhelm the world's ability to deal with them. Indonesian activists have come up with an idea to convince people to rethink their habits and say no to single-use bags and bottles. Environmentalists have created a museum made entirely from plastic waste in the town of Gresing in East Java. It took them 3 months to collect used plastic items, ranging from bottles and bags to sachets and straws. They were all assembled from polluted rivers and beaches. The centerpiece of this museum is a statue whose skirt is made from single-use sachets of household items. The museum has become a popular location for selfies and has received more than 400 visitors since it opened last month.
I will definitely change my life habits. For example, like when I go to the market or to a grocery store that provides a plastic bag, I will switch to a tote bag. And when I buy a drink, I will use a tumbler.
Environmentalists say the plan behind the exhibition was to send a message about the world's worsening ocean plastic crisis. The plastic problem is particularly acute in Indonesia, a nation that ranks second only behind China for its volume of plastics that end up in the seas.
People around the world celebrate the changing seasons in different ways. In the U.S., an annual pumpkin contest is held to kick off the fall season. Each year, farmers and vegetable enthusiasts from across the U.S. gather in New England for the competition. Anyone bringing the largest homegrown pumpkin gets the prize. This year, a man from Abington, Connecticut, got the prize for his pumpkin weighing more than 2,000 pounds. Alex Noel explains how he worked hard to produce that giant pumpkin.
A nearly unlimited amount of work goes into producing a 2,000-pound-plus pumpkin. I put about 1,000 hours a season into 2 to 3 giant pumpkins, and you're lucky to even get that many by the end of the year. I'm out there watering, fertilizing, keeping excess water off if it's too rainy, which it was this year, spraying insecticides, spraying fungicides, pruning, training vines, propping up leaves at the end of the season, putting blankets on when it's cold out, heating cables, fans. I mean, the list goes on and on.
The New England Giant Pumpkin Way Off began at the Tops Field Fair in 1984. That year, the winner showcased a pumpkin weighing 196 kilograms. The Way Off has received worldwide recognition, too. Syria's ancient city of Aleppo seems getting a taste of normalcy amid reconstruction efforts and the war-ravaged city. A Syrian historian has also been contributing to make the city regain its lost glory. Ala al-Sayed is working to faithfully restore the lost sections of Aleppo's old city. For that, he is using documents and clippings he himself saved during the early years of the conflict. He says he came up with the idea to digitalize those documents in 2013. Then he embarked on organizing newspapers, books, and pamphlets while scanning each one to add to his digital library. Following the liberation of Aleppo, Ala came back to the city and started renovating historic places which are on the World Heritage List.
The North Dublin suburb of Howth has a new highly efficient firefighting crew. The group has 25 members, but none of them are human.
Howth was targeted by a lot of fire, and so there's a lot of gorse here, and it's very flammable. The goats, on the other hand, love gorse, so it's a win-win in that sense. I suppose the project also focuses on the old Irish goat, defining their role as a functional biodiversity crew. They're a hard-working crew. They're up for the job, they're keen to do it. It also instills key conservation grazing principles to tackle fire prevention, habitat management, and the control of invasive species. So it's the old Irish ladies that have a job to do here and are well able to do it.
The goats graze eagerly on the ample gorse bushes, which are highly inflammable and cause blazes in hot weather. The local council hopes their deployment will make Howth less susceptible to wildfires. Conservationists also hope that the project will contribute to the survival of the old Irish goats, which almost went extinct in the last century. Each member of the herd has a box around their neck with a built-in GPS device. If the goats stray too far, the gadget will ping and let the owner know.
Five Siberian tiger cubs born in a South Korean zoo have made their first public debut. The cubs were born at Everland Theme Park in Yongin in late June. Their birth brought joy and hope to wildlife enthusiasts as they are listed as endangered species. Zookeepers say it's unusual for Siberian tigers to give birth to five babies at once. South Korean people selected the cubs' names through an online vote. Many exotic fruit plants need the tropical climate to grow, but Assyrian is producing nearly 100 types of tropical fruits at his backyard in a coastal city of Tartus. Mohammed Hassan's passion for agriculture is to the extent that he left his job in media to build a farm. He managed to create a tropical environment at his compound, and that was the reason behind his success in growing fruits that are rare in many parts of the world. In fact, he has turned his farm into what he likes to be described as a tropical cave.
I came across the world of tropical fruits as some of them existed here. Many immigrants also helped me on this path. They bought me special varieties from India, South America, the Caribbean and other countries, even China. Currently, we grow 93 types of fruits.
Hassan's success has encouraged other Tartus residents to create their own farms. The government is also assisting Hassan with his unique business. His farm is now open to tourists and visitors where they can taste the products. Hassan says he has bigger plans for the future and is thinking about using his tropical environment to raise and breed rainforest animals. In Brazil, paleontologists have discovered the fossilized remains of a dinosaur that lived roughly 70 million years ago.
It's a bipedal dinosaur with short arms, around 5 meters long, and it was at the top of the food chain in the period in which it lived. It was the predator at the time.
Paleontologists say the fossil suggests a dinosaur species known as Kurupi itata was a meat eater. They found the ancient predator's remains at one of Brazil's richest sites for dinosaur findings in the city of Sao Paulo. The first piece of Kurupi itata's fossil was unearthed during an excavation work in 2002. Until the completion of the research, a model of this species would be on display at Monte Alto's Museum of Paleontology. Experts believe the discovery would help scientists better understand paleontology on Brazilian lands. Most of us know the feeling of being moved by a work of art. A Kosovo artist tries to make us understand a form of political discourse through a mosaic of outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Alkant Pajogo has made a Merkel mosaic from seeds. The artist says he wished to thank the German leader for having been an example for all the women of the world. He says his work is also a tribute to the towering lady for the support she had given to his country, which declared its independence in 2008. Pajago was doing his work on the same day Germans were voting in the general elections to choose a successor to Merkel. Alkan Pajago holds two Guinness World Records for his giant mosaics made with seeds.
Technology plays an important role in our daily lives. This time, a French company has introduced a device to help the visually impaired to avoid obstacles. The smart electronic device detects obstacles and warns users with a beep. People with vision loss can install it on the top of their canes and receive information through headphones. The gadget helps people to dodge barriers on the ground and above that, for example, the open door of a truck.
If you hear the sound to the right, it means that the obstacle is on the right. If it is straight ahead, the obstacles are in front of you. So you change course according to what you hear. If you hear an obstacle to the left, you go to the right, and this way you can go around the obstacle.
The device costs around $2,300 and is now being used by hundreds of people in Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, and Switzerland.
Wally the Walrus has risen to fame with his extensive travels around Europe. Now the giant mammal has added Iceland to his list of trips. Wally has previously visited France, Spain and the UK. His last known location before Iceland was Ireland. Scientists were not sure at first if they had indeed seen Wally, but Seal Rescue Ireland recognized him from scars on his front flippers. The wandering walrus is 4 years old and weighs about a ton. He has covered a distance of around 5,000 kilometers in his recent trips. Wally is now on his way towards his home in the Arctic. A French zoo has had a very productive year, welcoming multiple new animals into its collection. Two pumas, two jaguars, nine Peruvian squirrel monkeys, and even rarer, macaque twins are new additions to Leminmi Zoo this summer. The animals were bred as part of a program designed to maintain and promote the conservation of endangered species. Once they reach the breeding age, these animals will be transported to other zoos to help boost the population of their species.
Now, a museum in Russia's Kaliningrad has unveiled a special exhibition to the public. It would not be exactly wrong to call the artworks out of trash. All the works exhibited are made of rubbish. The exhibition is showcasing a wide array of objects, including sculptures, musical instruments, robots, and costumes. The project was designed with the aim of raising awareness about recycling. People visiting the exhibition were delighted by the creative use of garbage. Only 7% of waste is recycled in Russia each year, while a vast amount of trash is stored in landfills.
An Egyptian artist is making incredibly tiny statues of famous historical figures and landmarks on pencil tips. 30-year-old Ibrahim Balala is based in the city of Rashid, south of Cairo. He has mastered the art of crafting miniature sculptures. Ibrahim mostly creates statues of Egyptian pharaohs, but Islamic, Greek, and Roman figures also feature in his portfolio. The artist received some criticism when he first ventured on his art, but he persevered and rose to prominence with his minuscule statues. Ibrahim's dream is to open a museum of miniature sculptures someday.
Fourteen lucky penguins have been returned to the seas off the Atlantic coast of Argentina after rehabilitating them from malnutrition and hypothermia. The Magellanic penguins waddled back happily into the chilly waters once they were released. They were distressed, malnourished, and dehydrated when they were found by conservationists in February. There are an estimated 2 to 3 million Magellanic penguins in the world. The cute birds are named after Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan. They are mostly found around Argentina and Chile.
Another groundbreaking archaeological discovery in Peru is now catching attention. 800-year-old human remains south of the capital, Lima, highlight the ancient burial rituals in the South American country. The remains of 8 adults and children buried in a common tomb were found by a group of workers laying gas pipes at the site. They were buried with food, dishes, and musical instruments, including flutes. Archaeologists say that the 8 people lived in the ancient town of Chilca, some 60 kilometers from Lima. They say some of the bodies were buried with the shells on their heads and had bags with cocoa leaves inside them. They say the discovery will shed more light on the pre-Hispanic history of the region. Another 30 human remains had been discovered in Chilca in 2018.
A taxi company in Thailand has turned its vehicles into mini vegetable gardens to help its drivers who are out of work due to the coronavirus pandemic.
The point of this project is so that employees have something to do to reduce stress. To a certain extent, it has helped with reducing our stress, but it isn't really the answer to the situation right now. Even though the drivers and the staff are able to harvest the vegetables for food, it's just part of solving the problem. I think the government should also step in to help us too.
The taxi company is growing vegetables on the roofs and hoods of 300 disused taxis that are parked idle.